This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, this week I want to introduce a guest that is quite different from any of those that we have had in the past, and I can't imagine ever having someone like this on again soon. Let me give you a little bit of history about where we're going with this, or where we've come from, I guess. Earlier this year, I attended the Magi Fest in Columbus, Ohio, and one of the guest speakers was going to be Werner Reich, who was a death camp magician, and he was the subject of the book written by William Rauscher, and there were others who were in the book as well as Werner, but he was the one upon who this whole book was written, and it was quite fascinating. And whenever I had heard that, I thought, boy, would that be just a wonderful gentleman to speak to. I'm sure he would be inspirational, and I was right. I'm so glad that Josh brought him into the Magi Fest for this year so that he could share his stories with all the registrants there. There were a lot more things he went into detail during the discussion with Josh at the convention, but he did recap some of those things in our conversation here. A few of the things that weren't discussed here, I kind of added on at the end of this particular podcast. Let me just say up front, for those who might be just a little bit squeamish of this particular episode, or those who perhaps might be a little bit sensitive, or that if you want to hear this before that your children do, I would suggest that you take a listen. But it does deal with a very difficult time in our world's history, specifically dealing with the Holocaust and the atrocities that were involved there. Our guest, Werner Reich, who is speaking with us today, was in Auschwitz for 3 years, and he was in another concentration camp before then as well, and goes into a little bit of detail, some of which is rather gruesome and gory. And so that's why I'm saying that this is not something that I'm putting down as explicit, because there's really nothing explicit except for some of the well, it's not really graphic violence, but it certainly doesn't leave out a lot of detail. Having said that, there are some things he does leave out, and I'll talk about that after the podcast is over at the end of this. But the reason, again, that I wanted to highlight this gentleman was because we are losing this generation of adults. In other words, those who have been in World War II and who have served or were interred in the concentration camps are dropping all the time. It seems like, well, literally every day right now, that we're having more and more deaths of our soldiers and all the veterans and other people who were involved in one aspect or another. And I think it's important to hear a story, particularly from a different perspective, of someone who was inside one of the camps and who knew a magician. Fascinating story. And it's one of those things that's kind of like an auto accident that you kind of, you know, it's gruesome that you don't want to turn away, you know, or you know, when you hide your eyes at a horror film, you keep your fingers open to kind of look. It's like, I don't want to see this, or I don't want to hear it, but goodness sakes, it is gripping. Nevertheless, I want to introduce my guest. Let him speak for himself here this week. It's a very serious subject, and something, though, that I think that you will enjoy. So please welcome my guest, Mr. Werner Reich, here on The Magic Word.
This is going to be some fun. I think I'm going to enjoy this already. I love you. Funny. All right. So this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. And I'm actually here in Columbus, Ohio at the Magi Fest. And one of the speakers that was part of the program here today was someone that I really came specifically to hear, because he was advertised on their website. And I thought he must have a tremendously interesting story. And he does. And that Josh talked with this gentleman for a while about his story, and I thought, well, it certainly bears some repeating, and also for putting in the archives for historical purposes and for magicians to learn from, because he's an inspirational gentleman, and he goes around the country then is talking and inspiring youth as well as adults. Wow. And we'll get into this, but let me just say that he is a Holocaust survivor and magician, Werner Reich. Werner. Hello.
How do you do? Pleased to meet you.
Now, may I call you Werner or Werner or Mr. Reich? What do you prefer?
Any version is fine.
Anything is fine.
Yeah, because nobody else is in the room, so I'm the only
answered
one
anything.
You can
precisely. It's just you and me. Exactly. And so the some questions that would be obvious that somebody might say, well, gee, there are not a lot of survivors who are left, or even World War II veterans, because that the war that ended so long ago. But when I first had read this, I thought, well, maybe that you were a survivor by doing magic actually in the camps.
No, so. I didn't do any magic in the camps.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I was with a magician who did magic in the camp. I found this out later. The SS men in Auschwitz, in the camp in which I was, they found out that this man was a magician. Mm-hmm. And they provided him with playing cards and I suppose some other small items. And he spent some time entertaining the SS and teaching them magic tricks.
And keeping alive that way.
And he was kept alive that way. That doesn't mean that this was the only reason he survived. You know, he could have caught any disease afterwards and, you know, in the camp or... He could have just, as the camp was closed down, he could have been sent to the gas chambers as well.
But he was being fed at least. I mean, he was, whereas the rest of you, well, we're getting way ahead of ourselves. So let's back up just a little bit, because you were, as I understand, born in Berlin and then moved to Croatia.
I was born in Germany, and in 1933, because we were Jewish, my father lost his job and my sister and I, we couldn't go to school, so we moved to Yugoslavia, because at that time, in 1933, people believed that Hitler would be over and out within a year or two, and that's many, many other people were found themselves in the same position. They moved from Germany to Czechoslovakia to Holland. Like Anne Frank moved to Holland. And so people moved locally and then hoping that within a couple of years
they'll be able to move back.
They will be able to go back. They didn't want to move at that time to distant countries. And as the time moved on, Europe was conquered by the Nazis, and countries like... America and Canada and Australia wouldn't accept refugees anymore. And so we were trapped there. And people were then, the countries were overtaken by the Nazis
surrounded.
And then they were exterminated.
And you had said also, I guess, when you had moved that you had to sell the house, and then there was a border tax, and they were taking... So basically, when you got to Croatia, you had next to nothing, I guess, and your father couldn't speak any Croat.
No, my father couldn't speak Croat. And at that time, Yugoslavia didn't need... My father was a mechanical and electrical engineer, and my father had... Yugoslavia had absolutely no need whatsoever for engineers because it was, and number one, it was strictly an agricultural country, and it had lots of raw materials, but they were all exported and remanufactured in Germany or in Austria and then brought back to Yugoslavia.
Right.
Yugoslavia at that time had a illiteracy rate of about 75%. So it just shows you that there wasn't manufacturing requires literacy. And so it was strictly agriculture. And they just didn't need any engineers.
I guess not. So did he end up farming then?
No. No, my father, he represented a couple of German companies. Sold their equipment, and he had a great, great struggle because our funds in Germany were confiscated by the government. We had to sell the house for next to nothing. When we left the country, there was, I think, a 25 or 50% tax mm-hmm. on everything that you took out. So we came there really impoverished.
Right. And you said that, thankfully, that your father had passed before that all this kind of began, I guess. He was fairly young.
My father died in 1940. Yugoslavia mm-hmm. was attacked in 1941.
Okay.
So just that gives you an idea. So from 1933 to 1940, mm-hmm. My father was around.
Yes. Okay. So then you were saying in Yugoslavia, and then what had happened? You had said earlier, I guess, that you had taken...
Well, my... 1940, my father died. 1941... Yugoslavia got attacked by Germany and taken over. Now, Yugoslavia was, before World War One, actually didn't exist. It was created in 1918.
What was that called?
It wasn't called anything. It was separate kingdoms, separate countries. Mm-hmm. There was Croatia, Serbia, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Macedonia, so they were separate countries, and they, each country, Slovenia, each country had its own religion, and they were fighting each other. They've been fighting each other for centuries.
Right.
And then after World War One, they were united into one country, and it stayed one country until 1941, when it broke up into separate countries, mm-hmm. and then it was reunited in 1945 by Tito, Josip Broz Tito, as Yugoslavia, mm-hmm. and then when Tito died, the country fell apart, and you had these various fights between the Serbians and the Bosnians and stuff like that.
Yes.
And so... and now it's all separate countries.
Gotcha. Okay. And so then, once that Germany had invaded that country then also, then what happened?
Well, Germany attacked Yugoslavia, and as I said, Yugoslavia fell apart back into original countries. Mm-hmm. Now, Slovenia and Croatia were in favor of the Nazi regime, mm-hmm. and Croatia had a ruler called Dr. Ante Pavelic, who was a fascist of the worst kind.
Wow.
They persecuted the Jews and Serbians and so on. So the Croats and the Slovenians were with Germany, and the other countries were against Germany.
Okay.
So now you have Serbia fighting the Germans, and Serbia, Croatia and Serbia fighting with each other, mm-hmm. and Serbia fighting the Bosnians,
well,
and Croatia fighting. So they were fighting each other and also Germany at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It was... like a sort of a cheap novel where, you know, sort of a make a cheap movie mm-hmm. out of it, but it was extremely difficult to follow.
Right. And then did they start rounding up the Jews at that point from other countries and then taking them?
Well, Croatia was rounding up the Jews.
Okay.
Croatia was rounding up the Jews. Croatia was exterminating.
And you were
there
about
were
13 then.
Six extermination. There were seven extermination camps during World War II.
In Croatia?
No.
In Germany?
They were all over.
Oh, okay.
Extermination camps. There were thousands of camps, but extermination camps.
Oh.
These were camps which were specifically designed to kill people. Camps like Sobibor, Treblinka, Auschwitz, Marley Trost in it. But these were all, six of them were in Poland. And only one of them, and the seventh one, was in Croatia. Okay. They killed there approximately 200,000 people. The number is not, some numbers estimate 600,000. The problem is that the one camp that they had, Jasenovac, was next to the river Sava. And they were killing the people and throwing them into the river. And the most people there died from either starvation, they were purposely starved to death, or they were had their throats cut. They had competitions between the various soldiers who can cut the most throats in one day.
In one day, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are things you really don't want to think about, because I had heard you know, stories about experiments in the camps and Dr. Mengele.
These experiments in the camps made the Croats look like babes in the woods.
Don't talk about that. That alone. So you, but these camps were kind of were spread out. Then would take people into the extermination camps from there. I mean, they kind of
they were transferred from regular camps to the extermination camps. I was at that time when the Germans attacked Yugoslavia. I was 13.
Okay.
And my father had died a couple of months before. My mother, there was my mother, my sister, and myself. And my mother felt very secure about her own life for two reasons. Number one, she was an American citizen, because her father fought during the Civil War, fought in the United States, and he became a citizen, and therefore my mother was a citizen. In addition to this, my mother fought in World War One for the Germans. She was a nurse in the German military, and she won the Iron Cross for saving the lives of several German soldiers.
Yes.
Who, when they were on the Eastern Front, the Germans threw gas bombs and the wind blew in the wrong direction and wiped out a bunch of Germans, and she helped save their lives. So she had a citation that the gratitude of the fatherland will be with you forever, and she believed in that.
Sure.
But so she felt safe between American citizenship and
and what she had done contributed for the German people and
precisely.
The soldiers.
Yeah. And obviously did not. The Americans said, yes, we will let you to come. We will let you come to America, provided that you pay a huge amount of money, which we didn't have. We just didn't have anything.
Right.
And so we were begging and pleading to go out, but it didn't help us. And so my mother felt secure under the Iron Cross,
right.
But she wasn't secure about my sister and myself. So she placed me with one family and my sister with another family. And I lived with these people for 2 years.
And you were saying also that the Germans were looking for the family you were with because
my mother couldn't have chosen the worse. They were looking more for the people who worked for the resistance than they were looking for Jews.
Right.
You know, and she placed me with this couple, and which was the most idiotic thing she could have done. And so they looked for these people, and after 2 years, they found them.
Yeah, they came knocking on the door, and but you couldn't do anything. I mean, you couldn't go by the window for those 2 years or anything. So then, once that they came and arrested them, and you then went to a camp
Well, I was arrested and I was beaten up and I was locked up in jails and I was for 6 weeks in Graz, Austria. Mm-hmm. And then I was in Vienna and eventually they shipped me to Terezin in Czechoslovakia. Mm-hmm. And I was in Terezin for 10 months. And I worked there laying railroad tracks. I exterminated vermin from the buildings. I was making baskets.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of anything and whatever they were telling you to do.
Yeah, well, sure.
But then we're coming to ultimately hear about magic where you had met
Then I got shipped to Auschwitz. And I bunked in Auschwitz next to a man who was extremely nice and kind to me. I was at that time 15, and he was something like 35.
Mm-hmm.
And we were lying next to each other, and he was always concerned about me, which not that he could have done anything.
So because you're saying you're on the top bunk, which is
I was on the top bunk. Yeah. I was at that time fit to climb, you know. I mean, not many people were fit to climb there. And one day I came back from something. I was working in the camp and leveling ground or whatever else it was. There wasn't really any work in Auschwitz.
Right.
And there he was. Sitting with a deck of cards.
Hmm.
Now, a deck of cards was something like a miracle because we had absolutely nothing. It's like being locked in an empty room, naked and locked in an empty room, and suddenly there's a deck of cards.
Because you said you'd been stripped of everything. They'd shaved your head and everything.
Yeah,
you
they shaved our pubic hair. Mm-hmm. They shaved our hair. Facial hair and head, and we had just underwear mm-hmm. and shirt and pants and jacket, and the pants and the jacket, they were made out of some material which today would be equivalent to dish towel material.
Was that not until you got into Auschwitz whenever they put the tattoo on your arm then, or was that earlier?
No, when I got to Auschwitz, I got the tattoo.
When they shaved your head and they were doing all
that. Yeah, that was all done at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's where I got my number. I had a different number in Terezin to the number that I got in Auschwitz. And when I was later transferred to Mauthausen, I got again a different number.
Did they tattoo each time?
No. Auschwitz... And I think one other camp were the only two camps that really tattooed.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was amazing. This guy had a deck of cards because you had said in the talk earlier today about how that someone had traded a gold watch for a slice of bread.
Well, somebody once, I know of a case where somebody brought in a gold Omega watch and he traded it in for a slice of bread. No, because, I mean, the watch was of absolutely no value. What the person who got the watch did with it afterwards, I haven't got the slightest idea, because, again, it was of no value.
Yeah, the food is important.
And, I mean, was absolutely...
That's why I want to give a little context. So when you saw these cards, it was like, where did they come from? And
you didn't know
this guy was a magician before either.
I've been trying... to find an analogy in today's life about the surprise that I had seeing these cards there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like walking into somebody's living room and seeing an elephant there. And even if you did that, even if you saw an elephant in somebody's living room,
right.
You can say, yeah, fine, okay, fine. There's a door here, you got the door. He got the elephant through the door, and he got it in the house.
You can figure it out.
But there was, everything was so limited and so restricted that the idea of getting cards particularly cards. I mean, I can't think of a more useless item than a deck of cards.
Right.
You know, I hate to say this to a magician, but it was, for the purpose of survival or for the purpose of comfort, the deck of cards is totally...
useless.
You know, totally, you know, it's like a bottle of perfume. I mean,
right.
You know, when you're dying there of hunger, what the hell do
you do? Yeah, if you're in a plane crash and it's going down, well, here's a bottle of perfume. That's not going to help you. kind of a thing. I understand. So you had not been talking with this gentleman before about him being a magician. So this is the first time you...
We were never talking.
Okay.
I didn't know, number one, what the cards were doing there. I didn't know what a magician was. Mm-hmm. I've never in my life seen a magic trick.
Okay.
Because...
Had you heard of Kalanag or at that point? No, Kalanag was a German illusionist.
I left Germany when I was 5 years old.
Okay.
And in Yugoslavia, there were no magicians and nobody performed magic, or if they did, I was not aware of it.
Yes.
You know, and here, maybe if there was a magician, would be a stage magician or somebody, with something big, but certainly not a deck of cards, which required dexterity.
Yes.
Is that a pun? Dexterity?
Yes. I think there is actually a book, Dexterity, D-E-C-K.
Yeah.
It's funny. That is funny. So what was the gentleman's name, by the way?
Pardon?
The magician, what was his name?
His name was, he was Levine.
Levine.
Levine. Herbert Levine. And which, I called him Mr. Levine, which was the normal way of children
addressing adults.
Addressing adults, mister.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there and he said, I'd like to show you something. And he took these cards and he showed me a card trick, which basically was the glide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he took the second card from the bottom and pulled it out instead of the bottom card and pretended it was the bottom card which he had shown me. And then he pulled out two other cards, and the card which I had chosen originally were not amongst them, and suddenly my card was there. That was the whole trick. The whole trick lasted from beginning to end maybe 2 minutes.
What was that experience like, first time seeing magic and that by a professional?
It was a combination of an unusual an item not belonging in the surroundings,
this world,
being
surreal,
used for some action which I have never seen before. You know, it's a
right,
and plus. The whole situation, there were too many mysterious elements in one blow, right? it was on the top of a bunk, performing on a stinking, dirty bunk, performing a magic trick.
Wow.
And then he did that. And... I was looking at him, and without blinking, he finished the trick, and he didn't even wait long for me to react. He said, "Let me explain what I did." And that, to this day, is one of the most amazing things, because that's not a normal reaction normal action
no.
of a magician. You know, a magician will show you a trick, and then if you say, can you explain it to me? He will say yes, you know, if you're right. a magician. If you're not, you know, right. obviously not. But he explained to me, a non-magician, a magic trick without me asking him.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know, that when you think about it, it's totally, you know, it's like you showing a layman a trick and then they say, let me explain it to you.
Right.
I mean, you would never in your...
Do you think that he was in a situation in the darkest of times and thinking, I want to pass this on to somebody else in case I don't come back tomorrow?
I haven't got the slightest idea why he did it. But the only thing I can think of, he had a son.
Mm-hmm.
His wife and son were both brought to Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. And his son must have been, I believe, something like 10 or 12 years old. And his wife and his son were both killed in Auschwitz.
Well, mm-hmm.
And he probably was yearning for his son.
Right.
And he saw in me his son.
Ah.
And that's probably what happened.
And he wanted to share that with you.
He wanted to.
Like family.
Or he probably realized, you know, how lonely and taken away I was from my own background.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to sum it all up, he had a beautiful, warm heart.
Yes.
And that's all we are dealing with.
That's true.
At this point.
So in later years, did you keep up with him? And or what ended up, what's the rest of the story?
No. There were roughly 5,000 people in the camp at that time. I came in May, and on the 6th of July, Dr. Mengele came in the camp.
Okay.
And I and a group of all the other young people had to run past Dr. Mengele. And it was selection time. We were stripped naked and we had to run for our lives. And we run, and he stood there, and occasionally with his head he nodded and somebody would go to the other side. And when he was finished with this first selection, there were something like 300 of us. And we had to run again, and then there were 200, and eventually there were 89 of us.
Okay.
And the 89 of us, we were transferred to another camp.
Mm-hmm.
And the other 5,000 or 4,900 or whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
over the next 5 days, were sent to the gas chambers.
You were one of the 89 survivors.
The entire camp was liquidated. And of the 89, 10 months later, when the war was over, there were only 46 of us still alive. And today there are maybe a dozen.
Wow. So Mr. Levine was one of the people who had survived then, or...
Pardon?
I said Mr. Levine was one of the people who had survived then also?
The magician, Levine,
mm-hmm.
was one of the people who they must have selected him out, and some other, there were a couple of hundred other people. Of
well,
the
because
camp.
We were saying at the beginning that he was entertaining the SS.
Yes,
yes.
So they probably spared him. I know that he went from Auschwitz to some other camps, and eventually he ended up in Germany, and he came to the United States, I think, 1947 or something like
right.
that, a couple of years. I don't know exactly when. I forgot.
And you said you ended up finding out that he lived somewhere near you.
Well, I was reading in 1977, I was reading The Linking Ring, and there was an obituary for the great Nivelli.
Okay. I think I've seen a poster of the Nivelli.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a note, something like about the Holocaust. And I read the obituary, and then they mentioned that he had a tattoo of A17, 1767 or something like that, whatever it was. And his name was Levine.
Right.
And suddenly it clicked. It must have been the same guy,
wow,
because I remember Levine and his number was very similar to mine. Mine was A1828. So we obviously came on the same transport.
Right.
From Terezin. And he died, and he died in New York.
And you live in Long Island?
No, I live on Long Island.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing.
It's not that far. Yeah, from where they're.
And I tried to find out, you know, from the linking ring.
How to get in contact with the family.
How, you know, who wrote the obituary. And they put me in touch with Bill Rauscher.
Okay.
And I wrote to Bill Rauscher, and my wife and I, we visited him in New Jersey. And I turned out that Bill Rauscher saw him 2 days before his
before he passed.
Death, performing at some convention.
Oh, he was still performing.
Yeah, he saw him performing.
He must have been in his 90s at the time, I'm guessing.
Oh, what?
No, you say that was in 77? That
he was in 1977.
Yeah, so
he was 69 or something like that. He wasn't very old.
Not, I guess that's right. And so, in talking with Bill,
he did the Metamorphosis.
Really?
Yeah, with his second wife. And it sort of seemed a little bit clumsy and belabored because there were two old people climbing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the perfect trick.
The Pendragons, everybody, yeah.
You know, for old people.
Well, so that's how you got to know Bill Rauscher, which came about for the book.
Yeah,
then.
So I got in touch with Bill Rauscher, and I had to visit friends of mine in Philadelphia, so I said, might as well visit Bill Rauscher. So my wife and I, we visited with Bill, and we had a beautiful, long conversation, and he was writing, he warmed up to the subject about magicians and Holocaust and so on, so on. I think he said, I'm going to write a book about Holocaust magicians, about people who were persecuted. And I said, well, I have my autobiography.
Right. And so that was the basis of it, from the autobiography.
He said, okay, I'm going to write the biographies of Jewish magicians who from Germany and so on, Czechoslovakia, people who died or who were persecuted or who existed. And then we saw in your autobiography. And so I gave him my autobiography.
Yes.
And he included it in his book.
How many other magicians are in the book? I haven't had a chance to read it or go through it yet.
I don't know. I mean, maybe dozen or so.
Oh, really? Now, were these people who were magicians just during that era, or were they actually Jews from the camps?
He floated a little bit before the Holocaust. He obviously floated before the Holocaust, because during the Holocaust, how much of a magician could you be? Hmm. And, you know, it wasn't much of a chance, particularly right. not in Germany. And then, sure. He wrote about these Jewish magicians, and obviously one before the Holocaust, and once they got into the Holocaust, you know, a couple of them got killed, and people escaped and stuff like that.
Right. Now, did you, after you learned that card trick then from Levine, and you said, by the way, I thought it was interesting that the name Novello, I guess, was Levine, and he added... It's,
well, what he, his name was Levine, and he... His stage name was Nivelli. What he did is he took Levine, turned it around, and it became Nivelle. Mm-hmm. And then he just added an L and an I. So you had Nivelli.
Nivelli,
which
yes.
is Levine.
Right. So he obviously had impressed you then, and
what?
With the card trick that you first learned.
The card trick impressed me, and although I never had touched the cards while I was in Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't dare. But he explained to me how he did it.
Right.
And it was burnt into my memory, burnt, because I was practicing that trick in my mind for the next year or so. And believe me, I was under the probably some of the world's worst conditions you can imagine.
Targets.
I mean, when I was liberated, I was 17 years old and I weighed 64 pounds.
Wow.
Just to give you an idea. Mm-hmm. You know, and I lost my toes on one foot and part of the toes on the other foot.
From walking barefoot?
I had severe bronchial asthma. I was a physical mess. I was a wreck. And yet, throughout that time, I was practicing that trick.
In your mind?
In my mind.
Yes.
And the interesting thing is this, when I eventually managed to get hold of a deck of cards, I could perform it because of the tremendous amount of practice that I put in.
You knew every detail because you'd gone over that in your mind. That was the happy place you went to for 10
years.
Yeah,
the movement, you know.
Of the glide. And
Yeah. I used that that approach.
Right.
Over the years, particularly when it came to simultaneously moving the left hand and the right hand for a move in magic.
Yes.
You know, I practiced this in my mind, and once I got it in my mind, then I could actually do it. Mm-hmm. I find that it worked for me.
So, yeah, to do something in your mind, first of all, you envision it, and then you do it. You know, I've heard that before, you know, like playing golf, you visualize the shot before you hit it, yeah. So you know that's where you want it to go, and the same kind of a thing, I guess, you practice a card trick in your mind, actually, then you pick up the deck of cards and do it. That's a different way of looking at it.
And then I came out of the camp. I showed this trick, and everybody was amazed.
Yes.
But I was a one-trick pony, you know. That was it. That was the beginning and the end of my magic repertoire.
You didn't know where else to go.
I had no magic book. I had no magic teacher. I had no magic tricks. I had a deck of cards and one lousy trick.
Yeah.
You know, and so when I moved to, I was after the war for 2 years in Yugoslavia, and when I moved to England after two years, I went in London, I think it was Hamlin's or one of the stores.
Harrods or somewhere.
And I bought a couple of magic tricks.
Mm-hmm.
Some, I don't know, you know, really cheap stuff.
Sure.
And I played around with that. But again, no contact with magicians.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my entire, a repertoire, if you will, my entire vision of magic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was it, finished. I haven't seen anything beyond
right.
what a demonstrator showed me in the store.
In the magic shop,
which was extremely limited. And when I came to America, I once read that Tannen's has a magic jubilee. And I surprised my family by saying, let's go there.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I didn't. I said, I have some business to do in Syracuse, and we'll drive to Syracuse.
Okay.
And on the way to Syracuse, I stopped at Brown's Hotel.
Brown's Hotel.
And said, this is where we are staying for the weekend.
Surprise.
Surprise. And that's where I met the most amazing magicians. I met Slidini.
Mm-hmm.
I met Goshman,
mm-hmm.
Johnny Thompson. I met a whole bunch of
legends.
People.
Yeah.
Magnificent artists. Harry Blackstone Jr.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people who were Mike Kevney. You know, and
it kind of changed your world then when you start
suddenly I saw something, particularly in the close-up world, that was to me, true magic. The magic was that the gentle handling of the items on the table.
Right.
Transform them into other happenings.
Mm-hmm.
It was truly magic, the magic of the fingers and the magic that occurred. You know,
yes.
It was an aesthetic experience, even if nothing would have happened, just the way they handled the items, the way they were placed in the hand, the way they were demonstrating thing. It was to me a brand new world, a world of beauty, of really truly artistic beauty. And I just fell in love with it.
Amazing.
And I was even at one point thinking of becoming a professional.
Yes, wow.
Yes, and then I decided very suddenly, I said to myself, no. Because I have so much pleasure in it, and if I would do it every day, that pleasure would be gone.
I understand.
And I worked as an industrial engineer all my life, and I loved my work,
mm-hmm.
and I loved my hobby.
And you can spend time on both.
And I have both. So life has been good to me. I enjoyed both. Of these.
That's an amazing attitude for the life that you've had and the hardships that you've endured to have that kind of perspective on life.
Oh, it was, to me, life has been very, very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
I have no complaints whatsoever.
Well, now, I understand that you also then go around and you talk to schools and things then now? And
I speak a great, great deal in schools. I just came back from a tour in Germany. I was supposed to have spoken there once, and then after they heard me speak, I spoke 7 times.
Mm, well.
Last January, I was invited to speak in Hong Kong. I spoke there 8 times.
Mm-hmm.
And in Macau, mm-hmm. I spoke in Portugal. I spoke in England. I'm going this year. I'm going to speak in Israel.
Wow. All over. So
and,
you're
and I'm also speaking in London again.
And you're 91 years young right now. So you got
I'm 91 years young. I may drop dead tomorrow, you know, but
I certainly hope not.
No,
you have so much more to live and share with other people.
Look, I am being blessed with reasonably good health right now.
Well, as we were walking over to the room to record this, I mean, you're quite spry. I mean, and you know, I see so many other people who are younger than you who are, you know, debilitated or crippled and having.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's not very often. It's not their fault.
Sure.
You know, it is their fault if they carry 150 pounds too much weight, you know,
right.
Or if they smoke or do something stupid, you
but
know.
But what is your secret to longevity?
And not dying.
I think I, who is it, Mel Brooks or matter of that? Not dying. Okay. Yeah, that's a secret. Don't die. You're killing me then, Werner. Okay. two last questions over there. That is your favorite type of magic really close-up magic, or do you like, I mean, I know you like watching, but as far as what you perform, is it mainly cards or coins or close-up?
No, I didn't do any cards. I'm exceedingly clumsy with cards. Really.
Okay.
I'm just too involved. I love the simplicity I love coins, which I did for a while. I did a whole long routine with just paper napkins, just tearing and restoring and stuff like that. I liked it because the plot is very simple. You start off with a small stack of paper napkins, and that's all the equipment you have.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a couple of cups, you know, where you start putting paper balls into the cups, and stuff like that. I like that. I like the simplicity. I don't like equipment. I also got involved into mentalism. I'm a member of the Psychic Entertainers Association.
Yep.
You know, but...
I know you and Ken Weber are good friends.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Being involved with that then, too.
No, it's... but I have only used magic. I used it a few times for entertaining of small groups. Without pay, and I used it a couple of times for demonstrating to some students with developmental problems to teach a lesson. But I don't mix magic with Holocaust. Because magic is a hell of a lot more interesting than the Holocaust, and nobody would listen to me. And, you know, I'm reminded of Harry Lorraine when he went into the memory business. He didn't even mention about magic, or so it was completely a separate field.
Right. Well, as we do start to wrap up, and I appreciate the time that we've had here in sharing these stories and everything that are quite personal to you and kind of your journey into magic and kind of how you got involved with all that. I appreciate that. But the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word, and I always like to conclude in asking my guests, what is it that is important to you? What is your philosophy of life? What do you live? It's not like, I mean, a magic word like abracadabra or whatever. What I mean is, it doesn't have to be a word. It can be a phrase. I mean, what's important to you?
What's important, when we were in Auschwitz, we had a saying, I'm glad that I'm in Auschwitz. If I wouldn't be glad, I'd still be in Auschwitz. Might as well be glad. And that has been my philosophy. If things are inevitable, that's it. Finish. Accept it. Be happy about it. And because if you wouldn't be happy, you'd still be in that same situation. And it's not going to make any difference if you walk around and you bitch and gripe and so on. Mm-hmm. The only person you're making unhappy is yourself.
Right. You don't want to live like
no,
that.
No, nobody else. Nobody else cares about these things. And that is life. And that's you have to accept it. And you have to learn to that, as they like to say, these things come with the territory.
Deal with it.
You know?
Yeah, when my wife was diagnosed with brain cancer, she said immediately, it is what it is, and just in accepting it.
Yeah, my wife had cancer for on and off for 25 years. Mm. And I tried to cope with it, and I...
Difficult.
Thinking of her still breaks my heart.
Well,
because
both
we were married, we were more than married for 61 years.
61.
She was the love of my life. Mm-hmm. She was one of the most wonderful and beautiful women I've ever met in my life. She was my dear, dear, dear friend.
Hmm. Mine as well. We had 43 years, so that's a heck of a note to leave on here.
But. It's enjoy life.
Exactly.
Enjoy whatever you have. It's here.
Right. It is what it is, and deal with it. And
yeah,
that's life. Werner, thank you very much. Appreciate your time, and you're an inspiration to hopefully the next generation, but several of us then as well. And that time here has been really precious. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. So for the Magic Word Podcast, as Werner Reich, and this is Scotty out. Well, I hope that wasn't too depressing, but I hope that what you take away from that is the positive attitude that Werner has. It's amazing for the life that he had and the experiences that he had to have such a positive attitude as he does. It would be easy, obviously, to be angry, to lash out, but I think because of his good nature and forgiving spirit that he has lived all these wonderful years into his 90s and hopefully for many more years to come. So again, Werner, thank you very much. I know that there, by the way, were some things that were not discussed in this because as we began the chat before we started recording, that he said there were some things that he would rather not talk about because he has buried these in his mind and he's trying not to bring those up. And so that's why I really didn't press him on any of these issues. But there were some things that he had discussed in the conversation he had with Joshua Jay during the Magi Fest, one of which had to do, he talked about having lost his toes, and he had talked about how that during this long death march that they were frozen, and he had a friend use an axe to chop off the toes to keep it from getting gangrene and moving up and killing him. Also, when he was saying he was on the top bunk, he was, he said because he was young, he was able to get on the top bunk, and that was good for him because there were three people, first of all, three different bunks, a lower, a middle, and an upper bunk, and he was able to get on the top bunk, and there were three of them, and the fellow who was the magician, Levine, that he had met was, I think, the guy who slept on his left, so he was the guy who was in the middle, so it was very tight quarters, but he said it was also an advantage to be on the top because if you're on the middle or the bottom bunk, then that's where the urine and diarrhea kind of filter down through there. So, yeah, pretty disgusting conditions, more than we could possibly imagine. So, again, a lot of those kinds of things that he talks about from time to time, and I'm sure has many more stories, but so many more that he has buried, and rightfully so, in order to keep his sanity, basically. So, anyhow, I want to thank Werner for his candidness and for taking the time that he did to talk with us about this and to relay this and let it being part of history. And I thank you guys for listening each week to the Magic Word Podcast also. I hope that you've enjoyed this. It's been a little bit different from what we typically have had on our podcast. We did try to keep bringing it back to magic and how that relates to his life and how that he kind of got involved with it. And I thought it was quite interesting then as well. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and whatever your circumstances, be happy. This is Scotty out.